So some Gita basics. First, let's recap where we are. This story really starts with a kind of formidable and almost surreal event, right? The warrior Arjuna instructs in the imperative tense in Sanskrit that his charioteer Krishna, about whom he has all sorts of suspicions and a great deal of complex relationship, to place their chariot between the two armies so that they can see those they are about to kill. The use of the imperative, the kind of in Sanskrit meaning do this, is relatively rare. It's only used for subordinates. It's a very kind of directive, almost impolite way to speak. And yet there's an assurity, a kind of confidence in Arjuna that comes from a long history of being obedient to lawful orders, such as it is, and of being part of something so much greater than himself and stationed in that hierarchy to understand who he is and what he's supposed to do and what his role is. To that end, Krishna's role in this story is going to shift dramatically. And that in itself is going to tell us a great deal about the strangeness of Mahabharata, because there have been incidents before that tell us that Krishna is far more than meets the eye, that he's not who we think he is. And yet part of the strange mystery, even the magic of the text, is that the rest of the text kind of drifts in and out of understanding who he is. As a footnote, in the chapter that follows the Bhagavad Gita, that isn't translated here because it's a little too much further along the way, Arjuna, our hero here, who has just, as it were, been treated to 700 verses, a significant portion of which have been committed to Krishna telling Arjuna precisely who and what he is, in fact, demonstrating it in no uncertain terms, right? In chapter 11, there is, as it were, a divine hierophany, an epiphany. There's Krishna literally demonstrating, as he calls it, his divine form. And we'll talk about that 11th chapter in some detail. But at the conclusion, just after this text, Arjuna seems in some ways to slip back into now who exactly this is. There's a kind of remembrance and forgetfulness feature that washes over Krishna. And it's certainly part of the characteristic of Krishna we call his maya, his illusion. And that's an important word because the word maya takes you, of course, to the English word measure and meter. It's usually translated illusion. Illusion's not a bad translation of the word maya if we understand it to mean more than one thing is plausible, right? So instead of thinking of an illusion as the opposite of reality, as something that's false, it would be better to think of an illusion as a way in which one is kind of conflated and confused about which possibility strikes you as the more plausible one. So my constantly iterated example is a silly one, but not unhelpful. I ask you, does a magician pull a rabbit out of a hat? And the answer is, well, clearly, there's a hat, there's the magician, he pulls the rabbit out of the hat. And you say, well, how does he do that? And then you say, well, do rabbits come from hats? And that clearly they don't, right? And so in that case, the sort of example falls apart because we think we can figure that out. But we end up in fundamental, irresolvable dilemmas in life. And that's part of what maya means. That is, we're confronted with two plausible possibilities. And we may or may not be able to suss out which one is true, or if both were true, or if neither are true. That is to say, irresolvability is going to be a kind of an important issue here in the entire Mahabharata, and particularly in the Gita. Now, that's going to be ironic because the objective of this text is clarification, right? It's to bring matters to a certain kind of certainty or imposition of certainty over what we're now seeing as a kind of devolving state of Arjuna's, one might say, fully justified sensibility that this is just wrong. I mean, his meltdown is not an unjustified experience. He sees his friends, his uncles, his relatives, his teachers, for complicated reasons on the other side of this battlefield. And he just says, no, I don't want to do this. And he retreats into a kind of emotional and then somatic meltdown. I mean, like, he shakes, he shivers, the bow slips from his hand, he falls down into the chariot, and he says, I will not fight. And that kind of ends chapter one right there. And you feel empathetic for him because this is an implausible thing. And he's further raising the idea that this is, that no matter how duty calls and how justified the claim is to the war, leaving aside its politics and his role in that decision making, that just feels wrong. This doesn't just feel wrong. This might just be wrong. That is, what in heaven's name could ever really allow you to feel as if fratricidal Armageddon is a good idea? I mean, whether or not it's an impeachable offense, it's wrong. And that becomes part of where the strategy of the text takes off. Now, for his part, again, Krishna has a complex relationship to him. He is here in the role of Suta, that's S-U-T-A. That's the word that means charioteer. But it also means bard. It means songster. So the traditional characters who recite the great epic Mahabharata are called Sutas. And Suta is in the epic understood to be a caste. It's a subcaste of the warriors themselves. And because the rules of war mean that the charioteers will likely survive the war, which in fact is not what happens in Mahabharata, because part of what Mahabharata is going to show us is that all the rules that we thought applied don't. Mahabharata is a slippery, deep slope into entropy, catastrophe, and failed cultural expectations and rules. So while charioteers are supposed to survive the battle because they are technically non-combatants, they don't always. Not in Mahabharata, when in some sense they should. That whole sense of moral entropy, of a kind of unraveling of the code of Dharma, is built into the greater epic. And this idea that there are irresolvable problems that are more than and different than that kind of devolving morality is part of Krishna's maya. So I want you to think about this in two ways, at least. And that is, things are going to go from bad to worse in ways that we can't even yet imagine. That's going to be kind of a basic assumption of epic thinking. That just when you think people keep their promises, or that there's cultural or historical provenance telling us what should happen, it breaks down. There's no guarantees anywhere. Furthermore, reality itself presents us not only with dilemmas that command our attention and demand a choice. Arjuna says, I will not fight. And he does, in some sense, represent the idea that in some sense, could be a plausible choice for him. Krishna wants to make it implausible. He wants to make it something that is unimaginably wrong, even though juxtaposed to the simple sensibility that we would all have that what is about to happen, that is a war between cousins that's going to lead to catastrophe and villainy and moral degradation on everyone's part, that all of that's going to fall apart too. So it's not just that moral dilemma leaves us with no good choice, which is really the kind of first checkpoint to make. Real moral dilemmas leave us with no good choices, but choices that must be made. And so the imperative of making an ethical choice in the face of moral degradation is understood to be like a principal issue philosophically before we even begin to ask ourselves, why is this plausible? Why is this war not justifiable? Because that has already been decided. The Gita is, in certain sense, not a just war text. The justification for this war is chapters and chapters before. And it goes back to what we said the last time. The problem is that the villains have stepped over those boundaries from autonomy and self-interest into worlds of selfishness and narcissism and nihilism, and that simply cannot be countenanced. This is where, as it were, the Hindu line is proverbially drawn in the sand. We just can't let people who are that depraved morally and that personally debased, we can't let the sociopaths run the world. It's just not okay. And we can't allow karma simply to run its course, which would be a basic Buddhist strategy. That is ahimsa. If we invoke a non-injury principle and a non-intervention and a principle to sort of run the world, because intervention will turn things from bad to worse, no matter how well-intentioned it is, right? One of the things we're going to find out is that the heroes of this story must sully themselves. They are morally compromised by making the best of worst choices. That's simply how this goes. Nobody comes out of life without ethical compromise, without choices they regret, without having to do things that they not only don't want to do, but will do and understand to have lasting and traumatic consequences for themselves. Let me put it another way. Some modality of PTSD is understood to be a normal state of human affairs. Just how particularly traumatized or wounded any of us end up being depends upon the peculiar circumstances. But this is not a peculiar condition, as the Mahabharata understands it. We're all going to run into places where the things we see and experience and the things we think we could have done or didn't do leave us irreparably wounded. And the idea is, how do we live with that? How do we survive that? Then how do you even flourish in a world in which that essentially is going to happen to everyone, right? No one gets out unscathed, unhurt. That's going to be a basic Mahabharata tenet. It's not a happy lesson. You know, it doesn't make you want to cheer and go home and say, because it doesn't leave you with a happily ever after. And that is definitely the ethos of the greater epic. We're going to find other sorts of really interesting thematic material that sort of saturates itself in the Gita. Because, again, Krishna is going to argue for clarity and certainty in a world that is almost, it would be comical if it weren't so tragic how fundamentally untrue that is. Right? So, because he's himself is going to make that less true. There's going to be a deep ambiguity and ambivalence simply about his identity. And then by the end of the text, Arjuna is going to say, I have heard what you have to say. I will do as you command. And some verses later, Krishna replies, do as you will. He gives him back his choice. He says, do as you desire. Now he wants him to desire to do the right thing. And then shortly after all of this thing is over, Arjuna promptly forgets everything. There's another text this is in the beginning of the sixth book of the Gita, right? Of the Mahabharata. There's a book further on called the Anugita, which means kind of the after Gita. It's almost never studied because it's a sort of like faux imitation, not quite so serious Gita. That reminds me of it's a pretty funny story. There's a place in India not far from Mumbai, from Bombay, called Aurangabad, which is interesting because it's named after one of the great villains of history. I mean, Aurangzeb is really like Stalin and Chairman Malik. He's a really bad guy. Like, Aurangzeb decapitated his father and murdered millions of people, and there's a town named after him. And his father was Shah Jahan, right? Who's the cat who built the Taj Mahal, right? As a kind of monument to his bride. The Taj Mahal is essentially a tomb. And Aurangzeb built a kind of faux Taj Mahal in Aurangabad and gets it kind of like crooked and a bit wrong. So one of the things that makes the Taj look the way it does down that long alleyway from the back of the room, such as it is, like why it looks so strangely magnificent, is that the minarets appear to be standing straight up. But because of the way optics works, and one of you could probably explain this to us, they're actually like this, right? Because if they were straight up, they would appear tilted in because of the way the optics create. Well, the guy who built the fake Taj in Aurangabad didn't get the memo. So the thing's a little like higgly-piggly. Like you look at this thing and you're going, wait, this is supposed to look like the Taj, and it kind of sucks. And there's a certain way in which the Anugita that follows the Bhagavad Gita, which is stuffed later on in the Mahabharata, kind of does the same thing. It's told these many books, chapters, verses later, because everybody forgets what was said earlier. I mean, literally, the shadow of Maya is really a kind of fundamental incapacity to learn the lessons of life, a kind of instrumental confusion that's built into ordinary human consciousness. But it really kind of tells us we will forget the important lessons and we will remain confused. Like that should be in pink highlighter somewhere in every notebook you ever write down, because somewhere along the line you'll say to yourself, I got this, I won't be confused, I won't make that mistake again, and then send me a postcard as soon as you do, because you will, right? So even if we do know right from wrong, part of the ethos of the text is that doesn't somehow preclude the possibility of making that mistake. My Indian teacher used to do this in a very sweet way. It was very fun to watch. I'll do it to Abby. So he would say, look at me. If you make a mistake, don't make it again. Got that? If you make it again, don't make it again. So on the one hand, it was this admonishment. And on the other hand, it was a bemused kind of response, not a forgiveness, not a softening of the idea, but simply the recognition that every time you tell yourself you're not going to do that same stupid thing again, beware. Chances are you will, right? So the Gita has this, seeks certainty, but it deals in ambivalence. Does that make sense? It traffics in a more complex understanding that certainty is problematic. Now, he wants certainty, but I contend that the only thing more dangerous than ignorance is certainty. And so he's trafficking in dangerous territory, because he wants Arjuna to fight and to do that, to rise to the occasion. He's going to insist on certain basic ideas as being incontrovertible. Now, that is not irrefutable. To do that, he's going to use a kind of twofold epistemology. Krishna's going to take a two-pronged strategy to try to get to the idea that there are things that we shouldn't dispute, or truths about the world that withstand or are resilient to the point of being incontrovertible. The first is he wants them to be demonstrably resilient under the terms of ordinary empiricism. That is to say, he wants the kind of truths we would call scientific. He wants you to look into the world, make your observations, draw out your evidence, reason your way to a conclusion, and arrive at the idea that under the best of circumstances, these are the sorts of things that withstand the tests of doubt and should be held as true. The second model he's going to use, and so the first model is essentially not far from our own scientific empiricism and rules of logic. And he's always going to leave room in that kind of a world for change and mutation, so there's going to be more truths and different kinds of truths, and we're going to have to alter our understandings. But he wants us to really come to the idea that when we get experimentally to the place where we think things are true, we should vest in that. We should take that seriously, and we should treat them as if they were incontrovertible. Pause on that, because about 90% of the science that you study in college is understood in exactly that way. They're not going through the first 4 years of chemistry saying to themselves, we're not sure this is right. They've been around the block with this long enough that they think that they'll never be shown to be wrong. That's why what you're learning is what we call received knowledge. When you go to a lab in a class like that, you're not finding something out. You're replaying an old story. That's a song everybody is supposed to already know, right? The second criterion for understanding truth is that Krishna is going to tell you that he has it, that he himself provides an authority that stands apart from other kinds of authorities. And he's going to list a whole slew of other genuinely reputable sorts of places where you learn things and you should trust in them. And so the first part of that argument is not unfamiliar to you. Like, when your second grade teacher pointed to the globe, this is literally what happened to me. Her name was Mrs. Robinson. She was like the only teacher who ever liked me. Right? Do you feel sorry for me? Okay, a little bit, maybe. Okay, because I was that kid. Right? So she points to the globe and she says, "The world's round." Now, you don't have to go to St. John's College to do the experiment to think that the world's round, right? That it, more or less round, right? As opposed to, say, flat. Let's not argue particularly about the details of shape here, but we get the idea. In other words, and because someone like Mrs. Robinson told you that, you don't go home and going, "You know what? I really got to do the experiment." That is, authority isn't vested in your empiricism. It's not invested in your experiment. It's invested in your trust. You literally have confidence. Think about that word in English, right? Confides means being with your heart. You're with fidelity. You are fidelitous with that. Because you don't think that someone like Mrs. Robinson would lie to you. Get the idea? So the first kind of authority is literally the concept of provenance. Look up that word. It means based on the past. P-R-O-V-A-N-A-C-E, I believe. Provenance, right? When things have provenance, there's experience, there's trust, there's commitment. There's a sense that it comes from a long legacy of trustworthy information. And it's not exactly faith. It's lineage, it's history. It's what we would call in the 21st century institutional knowledge. It's like those two guys who testified yesterday at the impeachment hearings. They're 50 years at the job, West Point graduates, this kind of thing. I mean, people who are of impeccable integrity, right? But you're not trusting them. You're trusting that they work in a world in which that's what they work in. They represent an institutional body of trustworthy practice and knowledge. That's the first kind of faith that Krishna wants you to have. Now he's going to overstep that boundary pretty quickly and tell you, and because I said it, whatever else has been said is true in its own way, but he's going to create a kind of super interventionary, sublative authority. Sublate, that's a word that'll be on your GREs, S-U-B-L-A-T-E, right? So when you sublate something, it means that the thing that came before is no longer as true as this thing. It means those other things are provisional, and this means superseding in that sense. It works exactly like the word supersede. Like, you supersede or you sublate. Sublate is to push the rest of it down, and supersede is to go past it. Get the idea? But the idea is that there's a kind of truth that Krishna is going to assign to himself that means, if I tell you, it's true. Now, as we're going to find out in short order, Arjuna is going to do a very kind of Indian thing. He's gonna demand that he shows him the money. Like, he's gonna say, "Why should I believe you?" Effectively. And he's gonna ask a whole series of complicated questions about that. And what Krishna's gonna do is he is gonna show him the money. That's gonna be the way the argument works. It's really important at this point to think that as we go forward, there is a concept of trust and providence and vesting in authority and in power. And we kind of want to use the word faith for that, but I want you to be extremely careful how you think about that. Because in the Indian case, especially in the Gita, in the Hindu case here, faith is not a placeholder for an experience that you haven't had yet, right? It's not some incomplete state that will then be finished off by knowledge. St. Paul says at one point, you see through a glass darkly, but then you shall see face to face. That is, faith is a provisional kind of truth for a more fulfilling knowledge that happens as an end game. That is not what they mean. They mean here a kind of providence, a kind of authority, that when you test it, it turns up right. So instead of you doing the testing such as it is, has been done or is laid out for you. Effectively, Krishna says, believe me. Arjuna says, show me the money. And Krishna goes, okay. You sure you want to see it? And he does. Now, whether he can remember that, whether he can sort that out, whether he isn't confused and overwhelmed and then forgets it later and botches the deal, doesn't mean that it isn't true. It means that in the Hindu case, truth is not merely insisted upon, it's demonstrated. They don't want it to remain unseen. They don't want it to remain untested. And testing your faith, we usually think of that in Western monotheisms as, well, my faith is being tested because I can't know, is the predicate to that sentence. And here the argument is never that you can't know. It's that you need to take up knowledge in different kinds of ways. The first kind is test it for yourself. The second is somebody gives you an experiment and you're going to trust them. And you're going to and those truths will be demonstrated, as it were, over the course of time. So when they say, when Krishna effectively says, "Believe me," he's saying, "Send me that postcard in 20 years, because when this becomes your experience, you'll go, 'Oh, he was right.'" But he isn't saying just believe, because it's a placeholder for not knowing. Compare that to the way faith is talked about in other traditions. It's not unimportant. Okay, let's dive into exactly where this argument goes. So Arjuna has this, what we might see as justifiable meltdown. And as I said last time, Krishna will have none of it. He attacks him on at least three grounds. The first is he tells him that this is deeply out of character. And he's personally insulting. That's the other kind of thing that's interesting about these sort of three strategies. He doesn't make some larger argument about truth. He goes right after Arjuna's own weaknesses. This is a deeply personal argument. And he calls him a eunuch. That, as I said last time too, is rather ironic, because Arjuna has previously in our story dressed himself up to look like a eunuch so that he could achieve, as it were, other ends. We'll talk about that another time. So he's going right for the jugular, and he's questioning his warrior character. By questioning him personally. So he takes the archetype of the warrior. He tells him, "You're being a coward." He literally uses the word cowardice. Right? And then he says, "And by the way, you, as a coward, make a really bad coward. As cowards go, it could look no worse than the way you're looking right now." And accuses him, literally attacks his virility, his sexuality. Arjuna's pretty reckless and promiscuous among the Pandava. Every time Arjuna says, "I'm going to go on a spiritual journey," he ends up with a weapon or a girl. That is essentially what happens to this guy. The second thing he says is he uses a very interesting term. He calls him anarya dishtam, which means kind of unfit for being an arya. That is, you're a disgrace to your, you want to say a disgrace to your race, but it really doesn't mean that. It means to the entire providence of our history. Because remember, these are the people who called themselves Arya, A-R-Y-A, the Aryans, right? It just meant us. But that word doesn't stand for an ethnicity or for a particular racial connotation. That word stands for our entire sense of history. That's the word for us, the big us, going back centuries and centuries. You're kind of a disgrace to your history. You're a disgrace to everything we've ever been. And you can say, well, why is that? Like, why such a big claim? Part of the argument has to be that Arjuna is meddling and interfering in matters of conscience that are, in some sense, not his job as the obedient third brother who's functioning as the general. This is, as it were, this is not his political call. Dharma does not, the dharma of arguing about whether this is a legitimate war or how he feels morally about killing his relatives is understood to be simply irrelevant. It's not his job. It's actually one of the sort of better features of the way the warrior class is understood inside this world in which dharma is a kind of code. It's a set of laws and duties and promises and arguments about justice and a kind of higher calling idea. Because it makes the pure force of the warrior not the issue, right? That is, Arjuna is the indomitable warrior. There's no one on the battlefield who's his peer, including his elder brother, who is the king, the ersatz prince, giving the orders. He could easily disobey the way Achilles disobeys in the Iliad. And he doesn't. Why? Because in this certain way, the military is a nonpartisan sort of civilian thing. It's run by the king. It's not run by his decision to do it or not to do it. Right? So when the government sends you to war, you may not like it. You may think it's unjust. You may think it's wrong. It may be a moral catastrophe for you. But it's different than the law. And the argument, the inverse of this argument, is that because Arjuna has so much power, so much force, because he is so much like Achilles, he could just blow it all off, right? The way Achilles does. You may not be familiar enough to know what happens in the Iliad. But basically, Achilles has a gripe with the Achaeans, and his side of the argument, his liege lord, such as it is, should be Agamemnon. And they're poised to go to war with the Trojans who have abducted Helen. And the answer Achilles gives is, not today. Not until I feel like it. Not until I want to. Because it all just depends. And he can withstand any challenge to that because effectively he stands for military force rights over political force. And that is simply not allowed in the Indian case. There's this thing called dharma. And we answer to the political will of that somehow represents justice over our own individual power, much less our own moral compulsions. So the first thing he's told is that he's a personal failure in cowardice. The second thing he's told is he's a disgrace to everything we've stood for in the past. Last, he's essentially given license to vent all of his objections and moral trepidations. In other words, Krishna lets him go on and doesn't court-martial him, takes him to task. Right? I mean, he's brutally unsympathetic to this argument and deeply personal. But he lets him vent until the third thing happens, and that is he has to have his own change of heart, his own change of mind. And that's exactly what happens. He pauses, he raises the doubt, he says, please help me. And then we get this very sort of strange response. Krishna, the text says, as if he were smiling. It's smiva in Sanskrit. So smi is to smile or to laugh or to chuckle or to be bemused, right? And smiva means as if he was just smirking. My little Italian mother would have said, with that look on his face, in a New Jersey sense of the word, hey, get that look off your face. So, because Krishna just gives him this like, okay. Because the third thing is that everyone has to come to it for themselves. And what they have to come to is this breakdown, this moment of doubt, this sort of deeply ambivalent need for help. The idea that you can figure out the world by yourself is probably the gravest misconception you'll ever suffer. Right? There's long histories, there's authorities, there's institutions, there's the simple need to enter into a conversation, because in a certain way what Arjuna is saying right before Krishna kind of catapults into the rest of the text is that I've given this every consideration I can think of, and that's not enough, so help me. And that's really the important point, because you can't see yourself until you enter a conversation that goes past yourself. That's the argument. You don't just need help. You need to be able to voice what it is you feel and then get serious feedback. That's the argument here. And notice what Krishna has done here in chapter 2, leading into 3. He's let him complain. He's let him voice all of his objections. He's let him articulate his moral dilemma for himself, right? So he's let it all out. And then he waits. That's the sensibility. He waits for Arjuna to say, okay, that's all I got. Now I need help. Because that's the next piece of the story. No matter how well you've thought it out, without a serious conversation, you can't get to the next level. You have to have another kind of conversation with more than your deepest own self-considerations. Okay. So, then we catapult into the text. And this is where in chapters 2 and 3 through 4, it gets really pretty interesting. The first thing that Krishna does is, I would say, has always struck me, and I don't know how you read it any other way, as a kind of an odd first response. And we'll deal with it. We'll try to interpret what happens. But basically, what he says is, the first line means to encapsulate the entire previous argument in Krishna's reply. He says, you grieve for those who warrant no grief, even as you speak to wise teaching. Right? So he gives him the benefit of every doubt about his entire moral breakdown. And then he says, but you know what? They're not really worth it. And he doesn't explain further, but this is almost as far as he goes into saying, you know, your cousin over there who's leading the other army, he's a sociopath. He's deeply, deeply troubled, and he's set them all on this road that they can't turn away from. They are being led by a sociopath. And the reason he's a sociopath is that he's willing to burn down the whole world and himself when in fact he could come to a greater sense of accommodation and live by Dharma, and so he doesn't. And so he says, and this is a really interesting kind of first thing to say. He says, it's not worth troubling yourself over people who are that villainous, who have stepped into a kind of narcissism that leads to nihilism. He says, don't grieve for them. Just get on with it. That the soldiers behind that are innocents, in some sense, just obeying orders, doesn't mean that should not trouble you. Let's turn it into a late 20th century serious moral dilemma. Right? It's 1945, and the Japanese Empire is getting smaller and smaller, all the way down to the islands of Japan. Right? And what have they done? The Manhattan Project has figured out how to make mass and energy go kaboom. The problem is, will the Japanese ever surrender? Will they go down to the last person? How many more hundreds of thousands will die for the emperor, right? And the answer given, and I think it isn't let's drop the bomb, it's that people said to Truman that they're not going to surrender until it's a complete takeover. Not hundreds of thousands of our folks will die, and them. Way more, in fact, the argument is kind of strangely moralized. Way more will die without the bomb than with the bomb. Now, that is a morally unconscionable argument to annihilate 100,000 people at a time who just sort of got up in the morning and went to school, right? But the argument is, it's a pathology that we can't fix because it's an ideology run by a sociopath. It's literally exactly the same argument. It's not a happy thing. It's not a morally defensible thing to say, right? And that's the interesting part of Krishna's first argument. He isn't saying it's morally defensible to kill people who might, in some sense, just be obeying orders or who are innocent in the matter. He's saying when the entire matter involves something that is so egregiously over any legitimate boundary that this cannot warrant your grief. What he means is you can't let grief stop you from acting, no matter how badly it makes you feel. But it's all encapsulated, and this is really what's so odd, in that one sentence. He never makes the argument again. He just goes, he just says, sociopaths may not be allowed to run the world. And then it turns on the same argument that Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin made, which is the Nazis were ready at some level not to capitulate, but to sue for peace. And they went, no, this regime is evil, right? This ideology is wrong, right? This was even before, and they sort of knew what they were doing, which is dereliction and morally culpable on their parts. They knew the mass pogrom that was going on. But at least they had the decency not to make peace with these bastards, right? And that's essentially Krishna's very throwaway first line. Now, what happens next is uncanny because he doesn't continue with any kind of ethical philosophy. He turns immediately to metaphysics. He says, never was I not, ellipsis, nor you, or these lords of the people, nor will any of us ever not be, for all exist from now forward. For the embodied in this body, there is childhood, youth, and old age, and then again they immigrate to yet another body. Those who puzzle this are not confounded. The physical experiences causing us to feel cold, hot, pleasure, and pain, they are transient. They come and go. Withstand them, Bharata. The wise person whom they do not oppress, steady in pain and pleasure, bull among men, is prepared for immortality. Things that don't exist can't exist. Things that exist can't not exist. Those seeing both facts see the boundary between them. Stop there. That's a metaphysical argument. In other words, what's his argument? His argument is effectively, you came from eternity, you never really left eternity. You can't go anywhere because it's all eternity. And so all that really happens is that matter and energy traverse over body after body. There's time in an ordinary sense. And this is usually read as a kind of simple argument for the simple statement of transmigration, like death and rebirth, or we might call death and re-death, because what happens is you stop dying when you get the realization. And his first argument is, that's just what happens. But in fact, you aren't really killing anyone because all of this really is immortal in the first place. That's a very strange argument. Like, by the way, you know, people come and go. They're gonna die and be reborn. Don't let that bother you so much because eternity. Because being is being. I'll tell you, you want a really good exercise? Go look up this same passage in another translation and tell me what you think. Because I've puzzled over this for 40 years before I finally came up with things that don't exist can't exist. Things that exist can't not exist. And I'm telling you, the Sanskrit is just that weird as those sentences, except those sentences are pretty clear. Things that Things that exist can't not exist. He's arguing for a kind of metaphysical immortality. Now, the question is, how does that solve anything? other than to say, well, people, you know, people are just part of a process that comes and goes, in which there's death and rebirth and more re-death. And I think that there's kind of two solutions to this, if we think about it. The first is that he wants our metaphysical permanency, in some sense, to hierarchically provide the best answer we have for the nature of reality. In other words, he wants us to think that when we know the facts of immortality, that will change the way we act in the everyday world. Simply the statement that you can't be annihilated should change your life dramatically. You're a participant in eternity, he says. Things just come and go, because things that can't happen won't happen, and things that do happen always happen. And so he's literally arguing in a kind of physics, metaphysical way about a fact of reality. And he wants to say first that fact needs to sink in, because if it does, it changes everything. Now, the reason that there's a kind of second piece to that argument is that I'm not so sure I'm convinced by that argument. In other words, if everything's kind of an E equals MC squared world, and I was here before, and now I just happen to be here, and then I'm going to die, and then I'll go back to it, and there's no coming and going because we're all just being, we're all just part of a cycle of being. I'm not sure that changes the way I view things any more than the second piece of the argument, which is I think that he thinks that this provides a kind of, he just told him not to grieve, but I think this provides a kind of consolation. In other words, don't feel too badly about killing them, because they're just part of eternity too. So the first part of the argument is if you think this, everything about your life changes. Like once you know you are truly an immortal being, even in the physical sense of coming and going, that should impact your life. You should act from the standpoint of ultimacy, is the first argument. The second argument is the standpoint of ultimacy confers us a certain power over the world. Like you shouldn't grieve over a world where killing villains is a bad thing, because you're really doing you're really not doing any harm in any particular sense. If you're puzzled by that argument, read this for 10,000 times. And tell me what you think this is saying, because this is a very sort of strange way to start things off. One second. So because the first thing he wants to tell you is that this isn't the moral dilemma you think it is. Stop grieving. They're not worth it. They're sociopaths. Let it go. Just do your duty. But then he launches into this argument about the nature of being itself. And that is, well, if you understood you were immortal, you would change, you wouldn't take this so hard. And by the way, you don't have to take this so hard, because those guys suck, and you're doing the rest of the world a favor, is going to be where this goes. You're not only not doing any harm to them because you can't kill them, because no more can something die than something can be born in a scheme in which everything is eternal. You're effectively doing the world a favor by just moving them along. They're going to be reborn next also. And since they can't be any worse than they are, let's get rid of them now. It's a decidedly Indian argument. I mean, because again, in contrast to the Greeks, when the Greeks talk about dying or they talk about killing people, they mean dead. Like you might get up to, you know, the river Lethe and forget, and there's some kind of like weird afterlife thing, but they don't care. The Greeks are like, you're alive, dead is dead. The Indians are, wait a second, we're in a big cycle of being. And when people are perfectly rancid and doing things that cannot in any way be justified, and you're doing the Dharma, then killing them isn't a problem. Chaitanya.
It just kind of seems like, because with the argument that like it's all just like kind of an immortal being,
yeah,
doesn't that justify doing anything, because you're not really.
Well, that's a really good observation. So doesn't the claim that you're an immortal being just sort of let anything go? And the answer is going to be no. Why? Well, because as for the world, there are rules for the world. And so he's going to do the same thing that we saw earlier in the Upanishad, and he's going to use the same model of materiality and spirit. And he's going to say, Prakriti and Purusha, as we talked about in the Katha Upanishad. So what he's effectively saying here is that in the material world of conditionality and transience, where bodies are young and then go old and then die and are reborn, there are rules for that. There's dharma for that. Turn this over to the realm of spirit, to Purusha, and Purusha is simply eternal. So you're quite right. It would look like he's using eternality to justify actions in the world, and he's really saying there are just two very different things going on at the same time. There's a world of conditionality in which mortality happens, and there are rules for that. And these guys have broken all of them, but flip it over, you can't kill them. But when you do kill them, they're eternal anyway. So he's using two sides of the argument to make a more complex point. In the material sense, dharma prevails. There are rules, and there's law, and a world without that is anarchy and not worth living in. And by the way, these guys are pathological. The other side of it is, eternally speaking, Purusha side speaking, let spirit's voice enter the conversation, which is what he does right away. He goes, well, in fact, in the ultimate sense, they're eternal. But ultimacy should relieve your grief, but not your responsibility to dharma. It should relieve the burden of mortality, but not the requisites of mortality. It should tell you that the unconditional presides over the conditional, but it doesn't relieve you of the necessity of living in a conditional world. So it's a more complex issue, because he's got this dual ontology theory. There's a material world that cycles eternally, and then there's this eternal principle that simply is and can't be destroyed and is unconditional. There's a Prakriti Purusha. And that's, as you see, if you read the introduction and studied the text at all, that's a backbone of the Gita's claim. Like that's part of how it wants to work out its business. We've got a little more time to get a little further down this road. So the next place he wants to go is he enters again into a fairly arcane arguments and strange deep waters. Some of which you would have to assume he can do because he's talking to Arjuna, who presumably has this 16-year plus education in the subject that he's talking about. Although Arjuna isn't sort of renowned for scholarship, they've all undergone the same kinds of fundamental instruction. And that idea of what's received knowledge to Arjuna and in this conversation is hard for us, right? Because Krishna is assuming Arjuna knows a lot of things about the world. For example, he never explains the cycle of death and rebirth as samsara. He just announces it. He just did. He just told you that that happens. You didn't stop. He didn't teach him that the world cycles and is reborn. He just knows he knows that. Well, he thinks he knows a lot about a lot of things that we wouldn't know about. And that's kind of where he goes next. But the other feature of this that's so strange is that, do remember, we are sitting on a battlefield. And in the first chat, in the first portions of this, we heard that there's clanging cymbals and timpani drums, and there's elephants trumpeting, and there's like the sound of chariots and horses, and there's a huge, enormous mishigas going on here that is of like a real tumult. And then they stop for 700 verses and they have a conversation that turns first to metaphysics and then dives into this next issue, because the next issue is, okay, so you remember those Brahmins who did the ritual sacrifice, who tried to organize the world transactionally, do this, get that? Well, let me tell you, their idea of action fails us. Why? Well, because firstly, the ritualists tell you that if you do X, you will get Y. Shazam, it doesn't seem to always work. That is to say, the results they promise you don't turn out. So he's in an arcane argument with the old Vedic ritualists, who are truly material scientists, right? They're saying, if we have the elements, if we have the material and the elements, if we have the recipe, the mantras, and the way to do things, and if we do it properly, we're always going to get the same result, right? Old Vedic ritualism, which we talked about at some length in the first part of the course, is a mechanistic view. It's a scientific materialism, right? It just says, do this, get that, so long as you know what you're doing and you have the right stuff to make it happen. Krishna says, well, first, that's not really what happens. The formulas don't always work out. But that's not the real problem with the ritualists. The real problem with the ritualists is that they have not learned how to act except to address their own desires. In other words, everything they do expecting a result. Not only are they doing everything expecting a result that they think they can guarantee, that all being first objection, they're doing things that they desire and expect to get results for, and all they're really doing is answering to their desires. Not to actions, not to principles, not to values, not to ideas, but just to what they want. That is going to be the trajectory of his next problem. Let me say it again more clearly so we can figure it out, and then you can go back and read through this section again, because this is the beginning of what he's going to call karma yoga. He wants to change the terms of karma, of action. Right? His first objection was, you do this and you don't get that. What's with that? That is, things don't work out the way you thought. But his more serious objection, the trajectory of his argument, it's going to be, but the real problem is, when you do things, you're just satisfying your desires. And that's no way to get the best things in life accomplished. The best way to get things in life accomplished is to put your desires in some deeper relationship to the principles that inform you. So that if you do something, whether you want to or not, you're doing it, as it were, for the right reasons, for a good cause, or just because it's right. And so then your motivation isn't for your desires or for the outcomes. Your motivation is to do the act because the act itself is worth doing. The act itself needs to be done. You're not parents, but someday most of you will be. You will wake up in the middle of the night, and your heart's desire will not say, oh, I need to wipe some ass and change a diaper. That is not going to be your heart's desire. What you will do is you will do it. You won't do it, and you could argue you'll do it for love. But Krishna's argument fundamentally is you'll do it because it's what needs to be done. Because that's what you're going to do. And that if you answered to your desires, you would mislead yourself. So instead, answer to the action for its own worth, for the value of the action. Now we'll return to this idea because it's really important. Because he isn't simply arguing act out of principle. He's arguing that the actions themselves have their own value. Don't mislead yourself by pointing to your desires or to putative results. We'll take this up again next week. Please read the text carefully. We're into the good stuff.